Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Obama described the failure to ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child as embarrassing, and he promised to review it.
Law professor Marjorie Cohn of Thomas Jefferson School of Law joins us to talk about her new series of articles on how the Obama administration can start undoing some of the damage Bush wrought. Part one of her series notes that Barack Obama spells hope for human rights. She wants Obama to ratify three major human rights treaties and the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, the ICC, established in 2002. First, a look at recent news coverage. President-elect Obama's transition team co-chair John Podesta held a press conference in Washington November 11th, announcing a gift ban on federal lobbyists making financial contributions to the transition or engaging in lobbying. Someone evidently asked about whether or not rumors of a quid pro quo offer to Barack Obama were true. The suggestion had been made that George Bush offered to agree on Barack Obama's plan to set up a bailout for the troubled auto industry if the president-elect would agree to a free trade agreement for Colombia.
There was no quid pro quo in the conversation. The president didn't try to link Colombia to the question of an economic recovery package going forward. They talked about both of them. The president stated his position on the fact that he thought that Colombia was an important agenda item.
John Podesta said while Bush was meeting with Barack Obama, he was meeting with White House Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton, and the two discussed both issues.
By the way, I also met with Mr. Bolton while the president-elect and the president were meeting, and we had a kind of parallel conversation, and we talked about the items that I mentioned, again, with no linkage between those items. But Mr. Bolton read the Colombia Free Trade Agreement with me, but in a conversation that was separate from the conversation about the economic recovery program.
Joshua Bolton was once general counsel to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. U.S. retailers and importers support the Colombian free trade deal because it would make Bush's duty-free benefits for apparel imports to the U.S. permanent. Barack Obama has been opposed over Colombia's repression of trade unionists. More than 2,500 trade unionists have been murdered in Colombia since 1986. 60 have been killed over the past 2 years. Barack Obama's plan for the auto industry could force companies like GM to manufacture green cars, something he talked about before audiences in Michigan in August.
A group of Democrat and Republican senators came down and came up with a compromise on energy that includes many of the proposals that I've worked on as a senator and many of the steps I've been calling on during the course of this campaign. It's a plan that would invest in renewable fuels and batteries for fuel-efficient cars, help automakers retool, and make a real investment in renewable sources of energy.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson just announced he cares about the auto industry, but has ruled out a bailout for Detroit with TARP money. TARP stands for Troubled Asset Relief Program. Paulson said the government has also backed away from a plan to buy troubled mortgage-related securities with the $700 billion bailout funds. Thus, behind the scenes, battle lines appear to be getting drawn over differences between Bush and Obama policy. And until Barack Obama and Joe Biden are in the Oval Office, there will be no way of knowing whether or not there will be a real shift in priorities in Washington, whether individuals and societies might be rescued, as opposed to banks and military or insurance companies. Meanwhile, the American people are increasingly aware of how Bush policies impact them. Polls show George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are the most unpopular president and vice president in U.S. history. Yet corporate TV news anchors and political pundits continue to push the Republican Party's talking points here and there. The question is, will Bush's team try to steer Barack Obama's first-term policies before they leave office, say through the use of leaks about trade deals and other kinds of pressure tactics to oppose Barack Obama's plans for a green economy or talks with Iranian leaders and negotiations with the Afghan Taliban? There are some interesting buzzwords being used in an effort to set limits on the incoming Obama-Biden administration. Obama is being urged to maintain continuity and be pragmatic. MSNBC's Mike Barnicle has reassured the conservative Joe Scarborough of Scarborough Report on the, quote, steady nature of Barack Obama. On Bloomberg Television, the Carlyle Group issued a clarion call for continuity for business as usual in Washington, which could mean continued fat profits for Carlyle and other companies like Halliburton, Bechtel, Blackwater, and ExxonMobil. CNN's Wolf Blitzer raised questions about how Barack Obama and Joe Biden can avoid sounding vindictive toward Republicans while responding to liberals that help get them elected. CNN Democratic pundit Steve McMahon issued reassurances that Americans will be surprised to learn the extent of Barack Obama's pragmatism. And pundits are advising Obama and his team to be bipartisan, that despite the fact that both houses of Congress are now dominated by Democrats. And in an interview with CNN's Heidi Collins, George W. Bush seemed to be practicing his own version of Obama's cool, calm, and concerned demeanor. Rocking back in his chair slightly, Bush offered hints about the post-election image he wants to create for himself as someone who cares about the world's poor and wants what's best for America, regardless of the fact that the next president, Barack Obama, may actually get credit for turning around the crisis George Bush helped create.
The election of Barack Obama is an historic moment for our country. There are a lot of people in America who did not believe they would ever see this day. And it is good for our country that people have hope in the system and feel vested in the future. And so President-elect Obama has a great opportunity, and I really do wish him all the best. I mean, I am just as American as he is American. And it is good for our country that the president succeeds.
Bush also expressed confidence that the U.S. will succeed in Iraq and Afghanistan under Obama, mentioning his concern for AIDS victims in Africa. And Bush has supported programs that have been of help to AIDS victims there. So that is what he will focus on, not Iraq's civilian dead, not dead coalition soldiers, and not millions of Afghan and Iraqi war victims and refugees. George Bush says he plans to write a book.
We'll probably write a book. I am going to, you know, I know I'm going to build a policy institute and a library at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. Other than that, I'm just not quite sure yet.
You have an outline for that book yet?
Yeah,
what's it going
to
look like?
I'm kind of beginning to think about it, you know, I want people to know what it was like to make some of the decisions I had to make. In other words, what was the moment like? You know, and I've been one of these, had one of these presidencies where I've had to make some tough calls, and I want people to know the truth about what it was like sitting in the Oval Office.
As president of the National Lawyers Guild, attorney Marjorie Cohn has worked to hold George Bush accountable. She is author of the book Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law, which chronicled his war of aggression, policy of torture, illegal killings, unlawful Guantanamo detentions, and secret spying on Americans. Marjorie Cohn, welcome.
My pleasure, Dory.
With so many crises to handle, should the Obama-Biden administration take the time to hold George Bush and Dick Cheney accountable for their failed policies and any violations of U.S. or international laws?
Absolutely. And I don't think that the Obama administration will, because it's clear that Barack Obama wants to be perceived as a uniter, not a divider. He wants to get Republicans on board with his agenda. So I don't think he will take on this issue, although he has said that as soon as he becomes president, he will look at the evidence to see if it warrants an investigation for criminal activity. He really should, because when people commit crimes, they should be held accountable, and especially when these heinous crimes that have been committed by Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and others in the administration have resulted in an illegal, unnecessary war that has killed almost 4,500 of our people and, by some accounts, up to a million Iraqis, and drained our treasury and contributed to the economic mess that we find ourselves in. The policy of torture, which is a systematic policy that was set at the top by officials in the Bush administration, ABC News reported they were meeting in the White House basement and authorizing torture on specific detainees, including waterboarding, and Bush admitted that they did that and he approved of it. That violates U.S. and international law, several treaties we've ratified and federal laws. And treaties we ratify are federal laws, but we also have statutes as well that prohibit torture, and torture constitutes a war crime. The killing of civilians by policies, rules of engagement that were set at the top, free fire zones where our soldiers could fire at anything that moves, resulting in the Haditha massacre and many other instances of killing of civilians, which I documented in my book, Cowboy Republic.
and also going in and bombing sovereign countries, such as we're doing in Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, and who knows where else. They also constitute war crimes. And then the illegal surveillance of Americans under Bush's secret terrorist surveillance program, and each violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, carries 5 years in prison. So, yes, they should be brought to justice by the next attorney general. It's possible that some state attorneys general might press murder charges against some of these people. That's highly unlikely. The more likely scenario is that other countries might prosecute leaders of the Bush administration under the well-established principle of universal jurisdiction, which Israel used to prosecute, convict, and execute Adolf Eichmann for his crimes during the Holocaust, even though they had no direct relationship with Israel. Universal jurisdiction, which the United States uses as well, says that certain crimes are so heinous, they're crimes against all of humanity, so any country can punish them. When some countries have tried to, say, bring charges against Donald Rumsfeld, the Bush administration has threatened and blackmailed them, and they've backed down. A good example is Belgium. Had charges pending against Donald Rumsfeld, and the Bush administration said, if you don't drop those charges and change your universal jurisdiction law, we're going to arrange to have the headquarters of NATO pulled out of Brussels, and Belgium backed down. But now that we have a new administration, or we will have a new administration, countries might be bolder, and depending upon how the Obama administration reacts to prosecutions abroad, we may see accountability, at least on the international level.
You know, it's interesting. Barack Obama has been contacting foreign leaders. We've just heard today in their press release that one of those called was the King of Jordan. Jordan, a signatory to the Rome Treaty, right?
Yeah, the Rome Treaty is called the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And before Bill Clinton left office, he put the United States signature on the Rome Treaty for the International Criminal Court. In May of 2002, George W. Bush took the U.S. signature off of the Rome Statute, which is, I think, probably a first. Virtually every Western democracy has ratified the International Criminal Court Treaty, but the Bush administration has sought to immunize its officials from becoming defendants in war crimes prosecutions. And they talk about the court being used politically. But the court statute, which was crafted by many countries for the last 50 years, including the United States, contains all kinds of checks and balances designed to ensure fairness. The 18 judges will be elected by the member states. The powers of the prosecutor are well regulated. Cases can be referred to the court by either the UN Security Council or individual member countries or the court's prosecutors. And the court would be a last resort only when a state, that is a country, cannot or will not prosecute one of its nationals. The United States says, well, the court doesn't contain due process protections, but it has Miranda-type warnings, the right to a speedy public trial, defense counsel, confrontation of witnesses, double jeopardy, and a provision for appealing convictions. Washington says, well, the court can take jurisdiction over nationals of a country that isn't a party to the statute if that person commits a crime in the territory of one of those countries. And that's nothing new. The United States has taken jurisdiction of foreign nationals in anti-terrorism, anti-narcotic trafficking, torture, and war crimes cases. So there's really no good reason for the United States not to ratify the International Criminal Court Treaty. There are all kinds of checks and balances. There are independent judges from many different countries, and it's been very political, and it's one way that the Bush administration has sought to immunize itself against war crimes prosecution.
With Bush-Cheney leaving office, is it conceivable that the Obama administration would feel secure enough to do this, even though, let's say hypothetically, refugees that have, you know, fled to Jordan could bring a case against U.S. forces for actions taken in Iraq?
The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court files the charges, not individuals. And if the United States were to ratify the International Criminal Court Treaty, then we would only be bound by that treaty prospectively, in other words, after our date of ratification. So it's probably not going to cover what happened in Iraq unless a country
finds a national of the United States on its soil and decides to send them to The Hague to be prosecuted. But once again, if the United States government were to hold these people accountable, then the International Criminal Court wouldn't even come into play.
Just go over four things that you have talked about in your new series of articles on what Barack Obama can do to improve human rights. And I know the Rome Treaty is one of those things, but go over those four things and talk about why you have at least some hope that Obama could improve human rights if he wanted to.
Yes, I am advocating in my four-part series that the United States ratify three of the major human rights treaties and the International Criminal Court statute. And the three human rights treaties that the United States has so far refused to ratify are, number one, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights; two, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women; and three, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. My first piece, which is called Obama Spells New Hope for Human Rights, and it's out on Common Dreams and Truth Out and my and other websites, including my own website, MarjorieCohn.com, talks about how the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt were instrumental in getting through the UN Security Council, in 1949, actually, enshrines two different kinds of rights. On the one hand, civil and political rights, and on the other hand, economic, social, and cultural rights. And those two different groups of rights have been enshrined in binding treaties. One is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the other is the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. But since the time of the Reagan administration, the U.S. policy has been to define human rights only in terms of civil and political rights, but to dismiss economic, social, and cultural rights as socialism. And the U.S. policy toward Cuba is a perfect example. The U.S. government criticizes civil and political rights in Cuba, but totally disregards Cuba's superior access to universal housing, health care, education, public accommodations, its paid maternity leave and equal pay rates. And the refusal of the United States to enshrine rights such as employment, the right to a job, education, food, housing, and health care, that's the reason why the U.S. doesn't ratify the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And just a few of the rights that are enshrined in this treaty are the right to work and the right to an adequate standard of living, to health care, education, housing, equal rights for women and men, the right to form and join trade unions, the right to social security and assistance to the family. When you look at our economic situation now, with more than 10 million people unemployed, 2 to 3 million families homeless every year, and 46 million with no health care, and people losing their retirement savings from the stock market crash, something really needs to be done. And certainly Obama has pledged to give this the rebuilding of our economy top priority and promised to create jobs. When Obama said he cut taxes for 95% of the people, but end the tax cuts for the rich, he was criticized for being socialist, for wanting to spread the wealth. But of course, his plan is fully consistent with our progressive income tax system. And after the election, 15,000 physicians called for a single-payer health care plan. And I hope that I've actually advocated that Obama and Congress seriously consider that. So the first treaty that I've discussed is the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which we should ratify. The second treaty is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. It's an outrage that we haven't ratified this one either. Over 185 countries, including more than 90% of the UN members, have ratified it. And the U.S. is the only democracy that refuses to ratify the most significant treaty that guarantees gender equality, but it reflects the ideological agenda and the considerable clout of the religious right and the corporate establishment, who say, oh my gosh, this, if we ratify this treaty, it's going to force us to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, you know, heaven forbid. And it could lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage and the abolition of single-sex schools and the creation of a nation of androgynous children. And this is based on, of course, false assumptions. Since Jimmy Carter signed the treaty in 1980, and I should say that there's a difference between signing and ratifying a treaty, and I should make that clear. When a country signs a treaty, that is an intent to ratify. That signals an intent to ratify the treaty and become a party to it.
And once a country signs a treaty, it is forbidden from taking action that's inconsistent with the object and purpose of the treaty. Once we ratify a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And yet, since Carter signed the Women's Convention in 1980, neither Reagan nor George W. Bush have sent it for ratification. During the Clinton administration, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee recommended ratification, but it has not been sent to the whole Senate at this point. So what does the Women's Convention do? Well, it basically mandates that countries take affirmative action to ensure equality for women in the areas of employment, education, health care, family planning, economic, political, cultural, social, and legal relations. And given the fact that there is significant inequality between the sexes in employment and education, in the political, economic, and cultural system, we need to ratify this treaty and make it part of U.S. law. I mean, women in the United States don't enjoy the guarantees of social welfare rights such as food, clothing, housing, health care, and decent working conditions. It took nearly 150 years for women to gain the right to vote, and there's no reason why the government should resist ratifying the Women's Convention. And the third human rights treaty that I will discuss in my series is the Convention on the Rights of the Child. There are 193 countries have ratified it, all of the members of the UN except for the United States and Somalia. And this convention enshrines certain basic rights for children, the right to life, the right to her name, his name, and identity, the right to be raised by parents within a family or cultural grouping, the right to have a relationship with both parents even if they're separated, and the right to privacy, the right to state their views, things that should not be controversial. Now, Clinton never did submit this treaty to the Senate for ratification. And one other thing I should explain is that when a president signs a treaty on behalf of the country, and then the president can decide whether or not to send the treaty to the Senate for advice and consent to ratification, and then the Senate will give its consent or not. Obama described the failure to ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child as embarrassing, and he promised to review it. This is what George W. Bush said about the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and this will give you a clue as to why he didn't send it for ratification. This is what Bush said. The Convention on the Rights of the Child may be a positive tool for promoting child welfare for those countries that have adopted it, but we believe the text goes too far when it asserts entitlements based on economic, social, and cultural rights. The human rights-based approach poses significant problems as used in this text. So once again, opposing the economic, social, and cultural rights. There is an organization called World Vision, largely evangelical Christian relief NGO, which supports ratification and says that Christians who seek to help the vulnerable, poor, needy, and oppressed apparently find more inspiration than fear in the words of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. That's a quote from David Smolin. And one thing that they object to is they say that it limits the fundamental right of parents to educate children in private schools because it requires that schools support the principles of the UN Charter. Another thing the Convention on the Rights of the Child does, which the United States is not willing to do, is to prohibit the sentencing of juveniles to life imprisonment without parole, which is something that most other so-called civilized countries have done. But basically, the conservatives say that this treaty would, quote, virtually undermine parents' rights as we know it in the United States. And I think this stems from the religious right. People want to homeschool their children teach them about creationism and not evolution, et cetera. So that's the third human rights treaty and then that I think we should ratify, that Barack Obama should immediately send to the Senate for advice and consent to ratification, as well as the treaty for the International Criminal Court.
We're speaking with Marjorie Cohn. She's president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie Cohn, the Reagan administration sort of turned around a lot of U.S. economic policies that helped people who were poor to overcome their limitations economically. And under Bill Clinton, the economy did better. But it seems the American people never gained an understanding about the combination of rights, assumed rights, and, you know, the U.S. administrations that they were dealing with, you know, in a democracy. Now we see these bailouts. We see economic incentive checks coming in the mail. But no one seems to be discussing this as a question of democratic rights. Do you think this is a good time for people to become more educated about all of these statutes and covenants that people have been fighting for years?
Absolutely, Dory, and that's why I'm writing this series. People need to, we have been conditioned to think that treaties are irrelevant, that there's something out there in the stratosphere, that they don't reflect U.S. law, they're just international law. And once again, I mean, the treaties that we ratify become part of U.S. domestic law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. For example, we've ratified the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. And that means that we cannot torture under any circumstances ever. We have ratified that treaty, and it says no exceptional circumstances, including a state of war, can ever be used as a justification for torture. We've passed a law, the torture statute, that actually criminalizes torture. And we have the War Crimes Act, which makes torture a war crime. That's another federal statute. So these are U.S. laws, and yet certainly the Bush administration does not honor them, badmouths them, and we need to know what our laws are and make sure that if there are other laws, such as these treaties proclaiming equality for women, for children, for economic, social, and cultural rights, that the United States, which claims to be a beacon of human rights and which criticizes other countries for their violations of human rights, that the United States should not be hypocritical here. And so, yes, I think this is a good time to talk about these as human rights and to urge that these treaties be ratified.
Marjorie Cohn, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dory.
You can find the series by Marjorie Cohn on how the Obama administration can start undoing some of the damage Bush wrought at her website, marjoriecohn.com. Her book is Cowboy Republic, 6 Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. It chronicles his war of aggression, policy of torture, illegal killings, unlawful Guantanamo detentions, and secret spying on Americans. During the press conference held by Barack Obama's transition team, the co-chair of that team, John Podesta, discussed research Obama's team is doing on George Bush's executive orders.
Senator Obama said that he wanted all executive orders reviewed. He made some specific pledges around certain executive orders during the course of the campaign. We do have those executive orders under review. We've been working on that. And we'll review all the executive orders that the president has issued. And that process is going on. We're in consultation with leadership on both sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill where appropriate. When we have announcements about specific executive orders, we'll make those. But as you know, he said something specific about stem cell research, so I think you could expect that what he said in the campaign will be fulfilled once he's in office.
A reporter also asked John Podesta about Guantanamo Prison and the Obama campaign promise to close the prison.
Senator Obama has said that he intends to close the facility at Guantanamo. That's a complicated matter. It's under review. I think that moving the process forward and undertaking the review of how one would exactly accomplish that is a project that the transition will undertake and then will be implemented by the new administration.
Also, the Obama transition team announced that it would send former Republican Congressman Jim Leach and former Secretary of the State Madeleine Albright to meet with delegations at the G20 summit on their behalf. Madeleine Albright is also former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. under Bill Clinton. Congressman Leach of Iowa served on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, chaired the Banking and Financial Services Committee and the Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, as well as the Congressional Executive Commission on China. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.